Hello and welcome. My name is Kyle, and this is How You Level Up, a podcast that decodes language to help you become your best self.
All right, should we get going? Who wants to, Kyle, do you want to like lead off and host, or how do you want to do it?
I appreciate the offer. I feel like whoever picked the book can sort of be the host at that for that episode, or at least lead.
Okay. All right. Let me think about how I want to do this. All right. I can just get started. So Breakneck is a book by Dan Wang. And I first heard about Dan on the blog he writes. I forget the blog name, but basically he puts out an annual letter, and he's been doing that for, I think, the last 5 years or so. And he's well known in the tech industry for these letters, because they're really, really comprehensive about everything going on in the tech world in China. And so he really made a name for himself with these annual letters. And then he released this book. I think he only released it maybe a few months ago, maybe 3 months ago or something. And I just started seeing really good reviews by a lot of tech people. Like if you look at some of the, like the CEO of Stripe, Patrick Collison, has a note here. Tyler Cowen is like one of the best economists. He has a note on the front cover. And so I didn't really know like too much what to expect. I had heard a little bit about it, the kind of dichotomy of the lawyerly society versus the engineering society. And that was really like an interesting idea to me. And that's one of the main reasons why I wanted to get into the book. So I would say, you know, really surpassed my expectations. It was extremely eye-opening book when he really talks about, and I thought he did such a good job of like weaving both US and China into the same conversation. And like he talked about China separately a lot, but then he would sort of compare it and contrast it to his experiences in the US, because he's lived in both countries. And I just thought the premise of the book is where, you know, there's two superpowers now. There's the US and China, and we're both really great countries in certain ways, and we're both really bad countries in other ways. And they just happen to be like the exact opposites, you know, like we're good for the reasons they're bad, and they're good for the reasons we're bad. And basically the premise of the book is China has mastered an engineering culture where they've surrounded the top brass of Xi are all engineers, and they've been able to engineer not only cities but also culture and society, right? With a flip of the switch, they're able to control huge parts of society. I guess I'm going on for a bit, but that was like sort of my overview. We can dive deeper, but I guess maybe Doug, you can get started of like overall impressions of the book, what you thought.
Yeah, I was really pleasantly surprised by how good it was. One, the writing was very accessible. And then I thought for the first time, I felt very connected to the Chinese people. I always felt like their culture was very opaque and kind of hard to penetrate. And the language is so distant from, you know, Latin and like these Germanic languages that we're kind of accustomed to. And our culture feels so distant, but I thought that he did a great job of really showing that sort of quirkiness that is the American spirit, that we consider to be the American spirit, is also kind of ingrained in the Chinese spirit a little bit. You know, when he was talking about like they're entrepreneurial, they're like kind of like they can be very, I don't know if crass is the right word, but sort of like gaudy or corny in a way. I thought that was funny in the beginning of the book when he said that, because I had never suspected that, and just I think the similarities for me, it really opened my eyes to China. But overall, I thought that dividing the book into, you know, and really detailing the lawyerly society versus the engineering society, it was a great way to it was almost like to tell Americans or Chinese things that they're doing wrong without being confrontational to it. It was just like an very observational approach. So I never felt like, oh, hyper criticized or anything like that, you know, from an American perspective. And I thought it was fascinating. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Kyle, what about you? Any overall impressions?
I completely agree with both of you in that the language was really accessible, and it allowed me to, you know, lift the veil of, hey, we think we know what China is about. We think we know how their culture works. And in my mind, I've always thought of China as this place that can build, knows how to build, and what they build might not always be great, but that doesn't mean that they're not learning along the way. I think Breakneck did a great job of detailing exactly how far they've come and how great they are at building, right? I didn't have all of the details of like what they could build. I see snippets of it on social media. I see cities that are not filled. And these are all part of what I now know of as political plans based on politicians being rotated through different sectors of China so that they can prove their worth or prove their ability in a different area. And by the way, yeah, I absolutely love that. To take a politician from one area and be like, you did a good job over here, we like you. Go have at it in this other area and see what you can do. That really forces the politician to adapt to problems that they may not have dealt with in their own, wherever they were elected, which is another point that we can touch on.
No one's elected.
Right.
Appointed. Excuse me. Appointed.
Appointed. Still, the idea of proving your mettle in a different area, I liked that. Of course, all of this is, we can dive into any points in Breakneck specifically, but I liked the idea of the politicians. I liked the idea of diving into the engineering side and focusing on, we want people who are leaders to be engineers rather than people who know how to circumvent the law and know where the loopholes are.
Like, not only do they appoint the people who've had success in smaller regions, but to even get those jobs in smaller regions, they make sure that they have accomplished or managed something like in the private industry. So most of the, you know, leaders of cities are former heads of, you know, big companies. And so you never have a situation there where it's like, and this is like, you know, this is a good and bad thing, right? Like, it's good that they're able to appoint really smart people, but it's bad that the people don't, the actual citizens of China have no say, right? Because some of them will, there's just no democracy there. It's not like we have here where everyone's elected, which sometimes results in really good people being in power, but a lot of times it results in people who have no experience at all, but they're just good at campaigning, right? And they're just good at social media videos and good marketers, right? But they actually don't have any managerial experience.
Are you talking about anyone specific?
But no, it happens a lot. But it does. Yeah. And Doug, to your point, I agree. It was nice to get a deeper, and Kyle, you touched on this too, but like, just get a deeper understanding of what's the hell is going on in China. Cause, you know, we only hear, like snippets or like news clips and
propaganda, really.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very
It is.
selective. And yeah, this book, and it's not like we know that much about what's going on, but we definitely know more than we did before. And it's interesting that most of what we hear as Americans are it's pretty negative about China, I would say, like for the most part, about like how authoritarian it is, and whether it's like whatever, and I had heard snippets of this too, but it's really interesting to go further on the fact that there's this trade-off that's been happening in China where the people, there's no democracy and the people don't have a say, but at the same time, the government is building things for them, for the people, right? And the government is producing and making life better for them, and driving a lot of people out of poverty, and driving a lot of manufacturing jobs and high speed trains so that everyone can get across the country, or especially so rural people can get into cities to work jobs. And housing, housing development is insane in China, where housing is so cheap. And so there's this interesting trade-off where, like, and it's not like they had a choice. The people didn't have a choice, but the Chinese government is very authoritarian, is going to do what they want to do. And in exchange for sort of like obedience from the people, the Chinese government promises to deliver on those results. Yeah, it's so there's a lot of good things, I would say, that has been happening in China over the last 30 years, 30, 40 years. Obviously, like, we can touch on some of the horrible things, starting with the one child policy, right? Which also was things we've probably all heard about before, but we didn't really know what actually happened. So it was really interesting to learn the specifics of that policy and how it came about with the scientist, like the army scientist who instituted it for Mao. Was it? No, it wasn't for Mao. It was the guy after Mao. Because
Deng Xiaoping.
Deng Xiaoping, because Mao was actually very pro population growth. He believed that higher population would result in just better military, more flourishing and more jobs and everything, so or just better economy. And then under Deng Xiaoping, he promoted this military scientist who got into like cybernetics, and went to some conference in Switzerland and learned about cybernetics, and like looked at some data, that showed that population growth was going to be out of control, and that the Chinese the country couldn't handle that kind of population growth. And they made a very, very drastic decision to institute one child policy, where every family in China can only have one kid. And like Doug, we talked about this the other night, but that was the most brutal chapter of the book, by far. It was the most brutal thing I've read in a long time. The ways that they instituted this policy. They did everything from like forced abortions to like kidnapping little babies, and sending them off to other countries, like really, really brutal stuff. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I was gonna say, that was for sure. I agree with you. That was one of the most brutal. I've read a lot of about the horrors of like World War II, and there's a book called The Rape of Nanking that's I recommend everyone read, but it's about what the Japanese did to the Chinese. And from I guess a literary perspective, I thought that's when the book I was like very shocked at his writing ability. But even more shocking was sort of, not sort of, was the methods that were employed to, see this policy through. And also, I thought what was crazy was the behavior of the populace. I was wondering, and I think I asked you this, Scott, the other night, is if they implemented something like that in America during the same period, let's say, let's even give it, like the grace of time. Do you think, I don't think people would have gone along with that in the same way.
Yeah, I mean, a point that he makes is it's probably unlikely that would work in America because of our system, you know, our legal system. It wouldn't have passed our lawyerly society. There would just be so many legal battles, and it would go to the Supreme Court, and it just would never get passed. And that's the kind of the key difference between China and the US for both good and bad reasons. The fact that China can basically get anything done very quickly is good in some ways for building trains and bridges, but horrible in other ways when they have terrible ideas, when the data, you know, steers them the wrong way. And that happens, like even with COVID, that happened, right? The data steered them the wrong way, and or the data that they had that they thought was correct steered them the wrong way. And so, I mean, I guess we did have, you know, lockdowns and stuff in the US, and we did have forced vaccine mandates, but that was, you know, only in certain states, right? Like, I don't think we'd ever have kind of like a federal you know, federal mandates like that. I hope not. I think it would have too much legal issues. What do you think, Kyle?
I think that some might argue the idea of abortion being accessible on the federal level is an equivalent in America to the one-child policy in China. And I wouldn't draw that conclusion. Like, if somebody brought that up to me as an argument, I would argue against it. But I think that based on people's beliefs in thinking that abortion is wrong, they might say it's very similar. One of the in, what I was thinking about constantly is like while reading the book is that there are so many edge cases that the lawyerly society has to account for because anybody can sue in the United States and a suit is held up. And when you try to build a product for edge cases, your product gets fucked. Like you have this thing that needs to account for every single scenario, and it never can work as a fluid system when it does that. You need to account for the majority of cases, and then the edge cases can go find a different product or fall into the system that is generated for them and use it as it was intended to be used by the developers. We account for edge cases in American society all the time, and that is the lawyerly society coming forward and like hampering our development, hampering our progress to do great things. I would say, you know, as like a to steel man the case against what I just said, we also have the example of Elon Musk, who can build really great things, has organizations that his end goal is to build a livable space on Mars. With his companies, he can do that. That doesn't exist inside of China because China, the moment anybody gains that much power, they cut them off at the knees. They're not going to allow you to control that many organizations who have that many contracts with private companies, with military companies. It's just not something they would allow. They would take over those organizations.
Yeah, it would be too much power at the hands of a private citizen for China to handle. 'Cause China's whole thing is the government is like the way of life there. Like everything is run and dictated by the government, right? Government has all the power, all the say, and it's a massive government, right? Like it's a ma massive in terms of just their influence on society. You know, they control every aspect of society there. And so, yeah, like the examples of Jack Ma, you know, of when Jack Ma was getting too, you know, too much money and too much power and too much fame, they basically kneecapped him and made him basically they didn't let his companies grow any further, and I think he just left the country.
If I can, something else that when reading that chapter, it was serendipitous that I came across a post on social media about China's population. I don't know if you guys saw this. I thought it was just crazy. to be reading that chapter and then to see this post on social media, which was about a Chinese dissident, so somebody who left the country and analyzes China, having lived there. And when you look at the numbers of when the one child policy was enacted and the population at the time, and you try to account for how many children does every couple need to have in order for them to go from the population that they were at back then and the population that they're at right now. It's actually not possible. Two things about this, which is China's population is comparable to India. India did not implement a one-child policy, and India's population grew drastically. China had this, what they say is a very successful policy, and yet their population still grew rapidly. The numbers are about you had to have had per couple 4 children in the decades that the one child policy was enacted for them to have a 1 point whatever billion population today. So, do I think that, having seen this post, not doing any research on my own, do I think that there
Of
is a
course.
chance China's population is not 1.3 whatever it is? Yeah. Like maybe a really high chance in, and I would account that percentage of it being correct to the percentage of America's GDP not being what it actually is, because Palantir had a agreement with OpenAI, and OpenAI had an agreement with Microsoft, and Microsoft then paid Palantir. You're just moving billions of dollars between three companies who are paying each other. And then you think to yourself, oh, GDP is now 3 billion, 300 billion if they all pay each other 100 billion. It's like, no, all you did was move money between
Yeah.
hands. Nothing
But
actually
Kyle,
happened.
on the population thing, yeah, I mean, you might be right. Like, actually, he mentions in this book, like, can't really trust any of the numbers coming out of China. But it's not that their population would collapse now. It's just that their demographics, their growth rates. So all they have an aging population, right? So they still have a ton of people, but most of the people are all old. Right, and the younger generations aren't having enough babies to maintain population growth. So once all of those old people die, which will be in the next 10, 20 years or whatever, they're gonna start to really crater, right? So that I think is the main point about population. They're fine in turn right now, but it's the projections, right? That like the growth rate is. And it's the same in Japan and South Korea, right? Like, fine populations now, their economies are good, but it's that next generation out where once the population hits a certain rate, the growth rate, and if it's below a certain number, which I think it's like one point something, it's eventually the country will just collapse, right? There'll just not be enough people. But still, you may be right about
Kyle, I saw the
the
same
numbers
post. I
being off.
100% agree. They're
Yeah.
fudging their
I
numbers.
just thought
I'm
it was
sorry, guys. I'm not
interesting.
on camera, but I just my phone's about to die. I'm looking for a charger. Kyle, 100%. These guys are
Right.
lying through their teeth. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I wanted to say the one thing I will say, just in case my phone dies and I can't locate a charger because I'm at this studio. I wanted to say the one thing I was a little frustrated that I thought he didn't dive into enough was, the reports of China stealing IP. And I thought that that was a kind of a big oversight on his part, because in order to get where they are, well, one, if they are stealing IP, which a lot of American companies claim that they are and that they have no legal recourse within China for IP theft. If that's true, that means that the quote unquote engineering society is sort of built on a fallacy, which in order to be to invent, let's say, the net what's coming next, if you're relying on stealing stuff, it seems like your society can't make very large lateral movements, let's say, and you could very, if someone tamps down on your ability to steal IP, or if we disconnect from China or the world disconnects from China and they lose access to the inventiveness of the rest of the world that, you know, they're not, that people aren't being rewarded for, who are inventing this stuff in other countries, you know, those products aren't making money for them in China, let's say, that you might see like a blow up of the quote unquote engineering state. You might just see the ugly aspects of it really come to rise, which is like a, you know, kind of a boot on the neck scenario, if I'm making any sense at all.
Yeah, one point about that is I thought the same thing, but slightly different. So he mentioned that it happens, right? He didn't deny the fact that China has stolen a lot of intellectual property, patents, and just trade secrets, whatever, from the U.S. He didn't deny that. What he did do was he downplayed it significantly. He said he claimed that it just wasn't a big deal because, like, we hear that as Americans, we hear it in the news and whatever, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, China. For many years, we heard that, right? Less so lately, less so in the last few years, but for a while, there'd be an article of, you know, China steals Boeing's, you know, plans for the new plane, whatever. He downplayed it. He said that we hear it in the news and we think that, and we have politicians who, you know, talk about it a lot and try and maybe like fearmonger a little bit of like China stealing all our stuff and then maybe they are stealing our little stuff, but he kind of suggested and had the theory that, it may have helped them, but it's not like it, that there were so many other factors that had them, you know, that made China become a world power.
I think if I could add to what you're saying, he really harped on the idea of, because China has so much manufacturing power, like they became the manufacturing hub of the world when we offshored all of our manufacturing. And so their process knowledge grew exponentially. And so when you have a whole bunch of factories that are all in the same area, he was like, look, you're going to have a manager who's getting drinks with another manager from a plant that's across the street, and they might scout him out and like hire him and take him. And he has all of this process knowledge that he then just unloads at the new factory. And I think that's a really good point. I don't think it discounts the stolen IP. Just wanted to add that in.
No, it's a good point. I think he downplayed it. I'm not sure if he's right or wrong. Like, I don't think any of us can say if how much of a difference stolen Chinese IP has made for their economy. I think it's really, really difficult for us to know that. But yeah, I agree, Doug. I think that when he wrote that, I was like, really? Like, you really don't think it made that big of a difference? Like,
right?
All our plans for whatever.
It's years of work, years of like toil and sweat of somebody, you know, I felt that. I did feel like he downplayed it, but to your point, Kyle, and one of the things that was really interesting is he says America was once like that. Like, we had, you know, manufacturing, we had these plants, and we had experts in those different processes. And, you know, there is the case to, like, you look around at our infrastructure, it's obviously deteriorating. You look around at certain aspects of our society. You know, for example, like working in real estate, I am astounded every time I walk through New York that it exists. Like, I can't believe, with all the zoning laws, with all the, you know, the cost to build now, that this place even exists. But our society built it at one point. So that was, you know, kind of taking what I learned out of the book and applying it to our life. We definitely did have that ability at some point. And
we did. Yeah, absolutely. In the starting probably like in the 1920s, like New York, when we built the Empire State.
No, it was a year. It was a year. Like it was 13 months, 13 months
or something like that.
But by the way, to build that building today would take you like 9 years.
Yeah, it would. And yeah, it was just, it was a building culture then, and there wasn't that lawyerly society yet where everything was getting bogged down. There wasn't a political party that, you know, got in the way of everything that you want to do, right? Whether it's, you know, for reasons like unions or environmental regulations, all these things contribute to our decaying infrastructure. And like the best example is the high-speed rail in California that has been like the biggest failed project, I think, probably of all time. It's like $100 billion over budget. They've barely built anything.
Scott,
It's
by
been
the
in
way,
development for like 15,
I'm
20
sorry to interrupt
years.
you, but I think
And it's
it's
just
we
all because
should
of.
clarify that that project is not only a stain on America, it's a stain on human history. Like, as far as failed projects and ideas go, it should be known that that is so disgraceful that you
And
should be up
some,
there with, like, throwing bodies over the wall with bubonic plague or something. Like, that is an equal act of destruction.
And you know what's interesting? And you know what's interesting about it too is no one's been held accountable, right? No one's been held accountable for it. No one's lost their job. And as we've read in this book, like, and I'm not suggesting this is a good way of doing it, but like the people who fuck up in China with their infrastructure, you don't see them again. Like they get demoted, whatever. They go to jail in some case. I think in some cases they might be killed, which I'm not suggesting that, but the point is, it's like, you know, you're held accountable if you make mistakes, and sometimes maybe to a too like too high of a degree, because like there was that example of the guy who just built a ton of stuff in some city, and it ended up just being he went overboard. He built too much, and he was still held accountable, even though like he was just trying to impress, you know, the higher ups. But he just like I guess was too extravagant. One interesting like also like thing to learn about the Chinese government, which I didn't know before, is like they're not real. I mean, they are communists, but like the name of their party is the Communist Party, but they're not really about redistributing wealth, which is one of the main tenets of communism, right? Like there's a passage here, rather than redistribute resources from the rich to the poor, the state builds infrastructure. Lenin used the term commanding heights of the economy to refer to the strategic sectors like power generation and transportation. In Guizhou, the commanding heights may well be seen from its tall bridges. So they're not taking money from and taxes are very low too, right, in China, which is super interesting. Like I didn't really know that. I would have thought taxes, especially for like the wealthy, would be very high. It's a communist society, but it's really not. Like their name, communists, I'm not sure is that valid anymore, because it's low taxes. It's not redistributing wealth. It's just taking money from taxes and building things, right? And building infrastructure. I thought that was interesting.
Let me add to that because it stood out to me too, which is this is an excerpt from the book. She has forcefully pushed back on the idea that China needs more generous welfare. In a major speech in 2021, he said, "Even when we have reached a higher level of development, we should not go overboard with social transfers, for we must avoid letting people get lazy from their sense of entitlement to welfare. Worrying that welfare could make the population lazy is one of those instances where a Communist Party leader sounds like Ronald Reagan."
It's interesting. You can't put a label on the Chinese government, right? They have aspects of the right, they have aspects of the left, of communism, socialism, but also of like free markets and capitalism. So it's like it's weird in that sense, you know. In America, we like label everything left or right, or you know, or centrist. It's kind of tough to do that in China. They just have these different policies that aren't really grounded in anything. I think it's just what the leaders think is the best, is
you know,
the best route.
It's really interesting. I saw,
you know, what they
an interview with this guy. I can't remember his name. I want to say it's Werner something. He's, I think he's Austrian or it's, what was, yeah, yeah. It's Werner Herzog.
Herzog? Werner Herzog?
Do you ever see that? Speaking of Werner Herzog, you ever see the, what's the Arctic documentary where he like films the nihilistic penguins? That is the funniest thing ever.
I haven't seen
he, it. He like films a penguin separating from the herd and it like just walks towards them. He's like, he goes towards the mountain away from, anyway, it's neither here nor there. But I saw this interview. He's an economist, and he was saying that the Chinese, the way that they built their economy and that they actually became, quote-unquote, more capitalistic is they decentralized. So they were hyper-centralized. I think they had one central bank under Mao, and, you know, most of the people were in, like, mired in poverty, and it was horrible. But they went to the Japanese, which was like a very humbling thing to do because the Japanese tortured them in World War II. And they asked the Japanese for the secret to finance because the Japanese were so successful financially, I think during the 80s or whatever. I can't remember what year this was. And the Japanese asked them, how many banks do you have? And the Chinese said, we have one. And the Japanese basically were like, no, you need to localize banks and open as many as you possibly can. So imagine in the banking system, there's, let's say it's 20 people in the central bank of China making decisions how to distribute money, you know, how to invest the money. That the Japanese were like, rather than that, open up local banks and the banks will make those decisions locally and you'll have more, not wealth redistribution, but you'll have more distribution of wealth, because the bankers are deciding who to invest in. And if you actually look at our current system, we're currently centralizing banks more and more. Like after 2008, more banks, how many banks closed? I forget the number of them, of local banks that closed. And those assets got bought up by JP Morgan's and these lot. Sorts of banks. So we're going reverse direction, which, you know, I think that to your point about political systems, communism, things being kind of in between and far removed from what we think of as communism or fascism or this, I think a lot of it has to do with the monetary system and the underlying principles that are applied to the marketplace. Like if the Chinese have a communist government, but they have people at a local level that are making decisions, you know, they're still quote unquote communist, but they're operating in maybe a more free market way than we're currently operating, you know, with banks becoming more centralized. And, you know, I feel like that's almost like sacrilegious to say living in the US, but, you know, maybe we're looking in the wrong place for where the danger really lies. You know, I personally believe communism is dangerous. That's me. But maybe the danger really relies in how money is distributed throughout an economy via decision makers rather than, you know, if you have 20 people making decision for a billion people, it's impossible. But if you have hundreds of thousands or a million people making those decisions inside of banks, you know, you have potential for success, maybe. So yeah, but this book, excellent, really opened my mind to different perspectives and ways to view something that I think we've been propagandized to view one way. And I think that Kyle's point was excellent when he said that, you know, it's propaganda. It is propaganda the way that we see them. And I thought it was really eye opening, man. I'm so happy you picked it, Scotty.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, it's a good one. Anything else, Kyle, that you want to talk about? Or
yeah, just let me add some thoughts. Because I looked it up the moment that you said it, Doug. There were over 500 banks that closed after the 2008 financial disaster in the U.S. And there are also near 4,000 commercial banks currently open. in the United States. So there's still a lot of banks that exist, but how much centralization of the banking system will we allow for before we say, okay, here's this bank that is taking too much, controlling too much, and what are we going to do about it? I think another part of this too,
Yeah, you're like shuffling.
Scott, for
It
whatever
sounds like you're
reason,
shuffling
you're
a deck
super
of
loud
cards. You're
right
about
now.
to. This guy's
Yeah,
playing
exactly.
mahjong with a Chinese ant that he picked up in
That's weird. Yeah,
the
because it wasn't. Yeah, sorry.
So how much will we allow people? And this, by the way, is a very like slippery slope of a question, where how much will we allow one entity, one organization to begin to control more and dictate the path that Americans take? Because that question leads to, well, let's do something about it and let's get the lawyers in there and let's take down that big organization because they're not allowed to exist because they have too much power and we should be afraid of them. And that's what diminishes our ability to progress. And yet, that's also what China does. They redirect their energies towards things that they think are beneficial. They can make very rapid left-right turns at 90 degrees, whereas it takes us 5 years to make a left turn because
Yep.
we've got to go through every circuit court and all the way up
Yeah.
to the Supreme Court just to make a decision on whether or not we should do a thing.
Yep, exactly. We move just way slower as a society, as a government, and again, it's hard because there's really good things about that too, right? Like
Yes.
nothing can change that drastically with a new president or a new whatever with a new government. But it also really comes back to bite us in the ass when it comes to innovation and technology and infrastructure, right? Housing, new laws to be more modern about AI and whatever. Like we can't, it's hard to keep up with a slow, lawyerly society in a fast-paced world, right? And it's a huge challenge for us, I think. Just real quick about the COVID section. I thought that was really interesting. Also just getting the insight into what happened during COVID years in China. They did really well at first. I mean, it's crazy. Like it started in China, which is crazy. They contained it when it started, and then they did incredibly well once they contained it after starting. And they controlled society, right? They had lockdowns way more intense than than our lockdowns here. You had an app where you had to show your app everywhere to get in places, which we also had here, but they had to, a bigger, more of an extreme. And then I think everything changed with that Shanghai lockdown, right? Because the Shanghai, and I didn't realize this fully, but Shanghai is their one city that's pretty Western. There's a lot of Americans there. It's very, as he talked about in the book, there's a lot of streets that look like you're in Paris. And once, Beijing, as he says, which is the government, focused their time, their effort on lockdowns in Shanghai, that's when the people there were like, holy shit, this is something that is really scary because there were food crises, right? There was a food crisis. They couldn't get the amount of food that they wanted because everything was locked down. They couldn't leave their apartments for weeks on end. They had to get tested, what every day, I think. That was interesting to read about. And I think that was a big shift, right? In the way that people who wouldn't normally care about what the government is doing, where it really affected you, right? And you're really like, this is, this is not good for my life, for my health, whatever. Do you guys have any thoughts on
You
the
want to go
COVID
ahead, Kyle? You
factor?
go ahead.
Yes. Yeah. I think that the lockdowns that they had, I didn't start seeing it until COVID, but because of the extreme lockdowns that China had, it was a 1-2 step into what are called 10-minute cities, where you're not allowed to travel outside of a certain area unless you have certain credentials or approvals. And I don't know enough about the 10-minute cities in China, but when they started to try and implement those in the UK, there were a bunch of vigilantes that started to destroy the hardware that would stop someone from leaving a 10-minute city. So I think it's very interesting that when it comes to China, they make these 90-degree left-right turns on policy. They can implement a 10-minute city, no problem. The moment that you start to apply that to a more Western country, you have people go, I'm not going to stand for this, and I'm going to do something about it. And that something about it is destruction of the property that the citizens believe
That's
inhibits their ability to be free
it's crazy you
in
say that
Western
because that
culture.
going back to the one child policy, that's how I felt. Like if someone tried to implement that here, like hey, you're not allowed to have well, you can only have one child, and you know, even if you saw somebody like getting rid of a little girl or something, people would lose their minds in this country. People would literally become hyper violent and start fighting each other. Like it would get crazy. You know, it's not like you just, oh yeah, sterilize me, I'm up next. You know, it's like I don't know. But yeah, the COVID chapter. How about, you know what was crazy about the COVID chapter was that like hippie town up in, what was the province? Yeah, it was in the mountains. It was like outside of the
Is it
cities,
Bali
which
or
confirms I've suspected for a long time that
yeah.
in like horrible countries that you like not everything is horrible everywhere. Like for example, in Russia, even in communist Russia, I'm sure the cities were absolutely god awful, like terrible. You're getting mugged, you're getting beat up by KGB, whatever. But I feel like in the countryside, people were kind of chilling. You know, and I'm sure the same is true in Venezuela or in, like, I remember this guy I used to work with. He said he went to Cuba in the 90s and he was in the city and they told him like, do not go outside at night in Havana. And so he went outside and he said literally all the lights were off in the entire city. Like they shut the power grid off. He said it was horrifying. Like it was really scary. He's like, but I made it back to the hotel. And then he's like, I wandered out of the city the next day and I got lost and I like was really lost. And these people, he's like, there was no food in the city either. I was eating like terrible, terrible food. He said, these people found him and he was like, he speaks Spanish. So he was telling them, like, oh, I'm so hungry. I'm on vacation here. And they were like, really? You're on vacation? Like, you want to eat with us? And he said, they walked to the beach and they had a feast, like literally, like lobsters and fruit, and he's like, it was like a paradise out, you know, in this communist country. So I thought it was kind of cool to see in China you have these sort of outside of the big cities, you have these mountainous areas, and these people are like, you know, they're like people here that live in the forest. They're another type of creature, you know. They're like another.
And the government just
Yeah,
has
you
less authority in those places, right? They're not able to instill so much control in the mountainous regions. So they kind of those people kind of
It
just
was
do
like
their own
when in
thing.
COVID, the
Yeah,
guy
it's
had
much
said it,
different
he went there
than the
during
cities.
COVID to get away from like the lockdown craziness or like being have, you know, the government stomping on your head. And I did the same thing. I flew to Mexico. I was in the mountains. I was hiding out there. Like, I related to him. This is a great Canadian man that wrote this book.
So, I think one other, I guess last thing for me maybe to talk about is like the, I thought the end of the book was really interesting with like where he talked about kind of what we talked about earlier, where we used to have this mentality that we can build things and we can, and I thought it was really interesting that he brought up Robert Moses. In New York, the New York City guy. I
Yeah.
think it was what, like, was that like the 40s or 50s or something? Where, or maybe 60s, where he did have this mentality of like, I'm going to build as much as possible, as much infrastructure as possible, and you're not going to get in my way. And if you do, I'll beat you or whatever. Like I'll take you down. And there wasn't like a super strong lawyerly society at that point, and he was able to accomplish a lot. Now, I think he also might have went a little bit overboard. I mean, I've heard people call him like super racist for, you know, for like building in poor areas. Or I'm not, I never read the biography, but yeah, like the end of the book, it talks about him, and it talks about like we need to have that mentality again as Americans, you know, especially in positions of power, of like I'm going to build this, and like there's nothing you can do to stop it, and like we're able to make trade-offs here. Like there's going to be, you know, maybe it is not great for the environment to build a huge new building, but it's worth it for housing prices to go down, right? Housing prices, in my view, and like we just saw this with the recent mayor election with Mamdani winning, is like housing prices, I think, is the key issue of our time, especially for younger people, right? Where it's really, really hard to buy a house right now, especially in cities, in especially like New York and San Francisco, and Kyle, even where you live, I'm sure that's really hard. And yeah, like he talks about how there's trade-offs you can make, but like we have to get in this mentality of building and engineering and not being so bureaucratic. And to me, like that was all well and good, but like I didn't like finish the book being like super optimistic at all. Because in my head, I'm just like,
It couldn't happen.
how would that happen, right? Like, how would we all of a sudden,
It couldn't happen. You
done
literally,
here in real
the
estate, so maybe
society
you
would
can
literally
talk about
have to
that.
collapse, and then, like the like let's say a city would literally have to collapse, and then you'd have to rebuild, like rehire the entire. You'd have to have some, visionary that goes in there and cuts like every position except for three, and just. I don't think, like, for example, the best, I think, Scott, we were talking about this the other night. 40% or 44% of all the buildings in the city, New York City, right now, are illegal according to the zoning laws. You couldn't build them, but they're because they're not far enough from the sidewalk or they're whatever it is. It's like it's so ingrained. The zoning law book is like this. I'm not sure you can do it unless you collapse, and because the government can't afford to pay workers, they literally get dissolved, and then you start again. Like I literally don't see any other way, because I don't know, even the way that people are voters are making decisions based on the information, information available to them or what they're being propagandized to believe is like anti-solutions. It's making it worse. It's like, let's put more people, let's centralize things more and give more power to these people who are just trying to collect a paycheck and are like scrolling Twitter for 90% of the days, and then last minute deciding what type of lighting poles you're going to use on your property that are going to cost you like $3 million. Literally, I just went through that exact scenario.
What government agency that you use publicly for citizens works efficiently? And if you can name 10, that's success. If you can name five, that would be great.
Can
But
you
there
name
isn't
one?
five.
Can you name
Can
one?
ex exactly. Can you name one? And giving more power to the government, which is inefficient already, makes more inefficiencies.
Yep. But people don't realize that. Like, that's, you know, people don't, you know, they're like, why did Mamdani win? Right? Like,
Because 12% of the population voted for him. There was a 20 some, between 20 and 30 voter age population turnout for that election.
What do you mean 12% voted for him?
The amount of people that voted for Mamdani that allowed him to win the mayor seat, it was 12% of the voting age population of New York City. That's not enough. Like, really? We need to have a blockchain technology on voting that everyone has on their phone that you can vote from work. It has to be easy.
Yeah, this is kind of a different topic, but Peter Thiel wrote a really good piece recently. Doug's
no, I agree with Kyle. I was agreeing. I was Peter thinking Thiel about it. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
He wrote that.
Of course he does. He's a psycho. That guy's a psycho. Which is very...
What's his reason
thinks,
for it?
He thinks higher voter turnout is means that there's more chance that like there the stakes are higher, essentially. So we had very high voter turnout relative to other elections in New York, and that's a bad sign according to him, because that means that like there was something important on the line. If we lived in a society where it's like it shouldn't matter that much, right? Like, because he's a libertarian too, so like his belief is like the government shouldn't, like it shouldn't be that consequential, because the government shouldn't have that much authority and power anyways.
I agree with that sentiment. I don't agree that we should have low turnout, because we should have the highest possible turnout. That would be a true democracy.
But what about lower? But there's a whole class of people who like are classified as low information voters, right? Do you really want those people voting where they don't know like anything about either candidate, right? Is that better than the current
really
system?
Really good question. I think if we look at Mamdani and knowing that he won with about 12%, and they're all what I believe. They're all more educated. I think the people who voted for Mamdani are higher education.
And wealthier, yeah.
And maybe wealthier, but they definitely have a lot of school. They've been exposed to a lot of what is the possibility of socialism? What is the possibility of communism? And I don't think more education means that you have the ability to make a smarter decision. I think more information, right, this is where it correlates to, more information does not make it better, make you better as a voter.
That's true. I agree with that. I think Kyle, the real problem is they started slapping degrees. Like they opened up degrees to the marketplace, and basically a bunch of like people who should have been, you know, moving rocks in like Northern Alberta, even though those guys are probably geniuses.
Yeah.
They thought that they were, you know, they should be, they basically gave these people the belief that they should be re-engineering entire societies. Like, you're so smart, you need to re-engineer everything. And you're like...
There's a couple of things that we could do. If I could snap my fingers, we could fix a lot of the U.S. government. But not all of it will ever be... It will ever be accepted, and a lot of it is,
guys, if I more ideological, if I may, before nature, I have to jump off, right? But like, I just want to give you guys a quick story. So one night I was trying to have lucid dreams, and it's going to relate to what you're saying. I was trying to have lucid dreams, and finally I achieved a lucid dream. So I go to sleep. I have a dream that my brother and sister are behind me. And they're really little, like they're little kids. And somebody's breaking into a building that I'm in. And I have a knife in my hand. And I feel like the guy's going to kill us. And I became so scared that I woke up in my dream and force pushed this guy through the door. Like I was aware, you know, like I'm awake. And I realized, oh my God, I'm dreaming. I'm like, what am I going to do? So I go outside and I'm like, I'm going to build the perfect brownstone. Like apartment, beautiful. I'm gonna make it as beautiful as I possibly can. So I'm doing this consciously, I start lifting up from the ground, like raising a brownstone, and boom, this perfect brownstone pops out of the ground. And then I get a weird feeling, and I like lean over and I look behind the brownstone, and I leveled the entire city. And I like destroyed, I literally must have killed millions in my dream. And sometimes I think,
wow,
if you think that you could snap your fingers and make everything right, you're like, I'm gonna do this one little good thing. You might crumble. You might crush everyone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, then I'll share one, which is a thing that's talked about in the public sphere a little bit more now, which is if politicians want to pass a regulation, a law, a bill, single item, it covers one topic, pass that one topic, then move on to the next. Don't throw 300 topics into a bill.
Okay, say, you snapped this. Your fingers. You got away with that one.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. They jam everything into a bill, knowing that most people, like, it's to hide what they're doing, mm-hmm. right? Because then the bill will be 100 pages or even 1,000 pages, and no one's going to actually read all that crap. And they can just kind of sneak in, you know, the things that they want for their, you know, whatever, for their donors or mm-hmm. whatever stuff they're doing, right? Because if they were really, you know, being upfront about what they wanted to accomplish, yeah, it would just be a simple bill. And all that, you know, it's kind of back to the lawyerly society, right? They have these lawyers draft up extremely complex bills and agreements and contracts, and that kind of obfuscates, right, you know, what's actually going on.
That's, you know, lobbyists too. That's another big one. That's just people trying to shove in whatever they got paid to shove in. But guys, I really have to run. I have to get out. I have to clean up the studio and then get out of here. But
Before you head out, let's we're reading the Technological Republic.
I ordered
Republic
it. You
want to
read it?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, I ordered it.
Is
I would
that
love
what
to read
we're
it.
Reading?
Yeah, I started it just to warn you guys. Like, it has like some similar themes as this book. It's definitely like not as approachable as this book. Alex Karp is very like philosophical and like very educated, and he's kind of like Peter Thiel, where he has more of like he's in tech, but he's also like kind of a philosopher, so he has sort of complex ideas. But I don't think that's a bad thing. I think it's a little bit harder to read than Breakneck, but it has some of the same themes of America sort of like decline, being in like very stagnant and like a little bit of a decline, and you know how we can fix that, and how Palantir is addressing these problems. So I'm only like 10 or 20 pages in, but it's very good so far.
Palantir to the rescue.
Never sold.
Yeah.
Can we please, because we skipped over the fiction book, can we please?
No. You can pick this, Kyle. I don't want the responsibility to picking after I picked the American Establishment.
I'm not reading. Yeah, I am not reading any of Doug's books.
Okay.
Sorry, I shouldn't say that. I'm vetting Doug's books very highly.
The Anglo-American Establishment. I know what I took out of that book. You guys might have taken nothing, but that was a life-changing book.
Did you? I took something. I did a whole episode on it.
Jeez, Coach, yeah, that was a tough one. That was a tough one. It was so hard.
So it was so tough. It was so tough. So after this book, then I'll pick the
Do
next
it.
One. I'm
Do
going
it.
To pick a fiction book.
All right, guys. Scotty, I'll text you. I really got to run.
What kind of
I'm
fiction?
Gonna be, I'm going to.
Okay.
This guy's going to walk in with, I don't know, Christina Aguilera or something, and I'm going to get yelled at.
Jesus.
All right. See you guys. Bye.
Thank you for listening to How You Level Up. If you're enjoying the show, subscribe and give a 5-star rating. There are new episodes each month asking questions about timeless communication lessons. language is a medium for sharing, and the knowledge unpacked here can be applied to anyone, anywhere, facing any challenge. If there's a question or topic you'd like me to dive into next, send a note to any of my connected social media accounts. This is all about how you level up.